Save big on your next project at Menards. Check out our huge selection of Richmond water heaters. Whether it's electric or gas, tank or tankless, Menards has what you need in stock. Ensure that you have hot water for when you need it most with a new Richmond water heater from Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. The Hawthorne at the View apartment complex sits on Old Chapel Hill Road, nestled in trees. It's right on the line between Chapel Hill and Durham, close enough to the University of North Carolina's campus to matter, far enough away that you have to mean to go there. There's one way in and one way out. On the morning of September 7th, 2012, Chapel Hill police responded to a 911 call from the second floor of the complex. A young woman had been found unresponsive. The caller told the dispatcher there was blood everywhere. What officers found when they arrived was a 19-year-old woman slumped against a bed, partly clothed, her shirt pulled up over her head. The caller had been right. I mean, there was so much blood on her body, on her clothing, on the bed sheet, spattered on the wall and the closet door. A Bacardi rum bottle that normally lived in the kitchen had been moved and might have been the murder weapon. A handwritten note on a fast food bag sat near the body. It did not have a drop of blood on it. The woman's name was Faith Danielle Hedgepeth. She was a biology major at UNC Chapel Hill, a Gates Millennium Scholar, a daughter, a sister. She was a member of the Halawasaponi tribe of North Carolina, one of the brightest students her community had ever sent to Chapel Hill, and she was weeks away from her 20th birthday. What followed was no ordinary criminal case. It would ultimately become one of the largest homicide investigations in the state's history, replete with red herrings and bogged down by online conspiracy theories that would muddle matters for investigators. It would take 9 agonizing years before anyone was arrested for her murder. Hi, everyone. As longtime listeners know, this show usually looks at older cases, sometimes really old ones, as in a couple of centuries back or so. But every so often, I detour from the show's usual format to do what I call a future Crimes of the Centuries episode. It's a bonus looking at a more recent case where the ending hasn't always been written yet. The institutional failure questions I usually get to examine in hindsight are still unfolding in real time. I do these episodes in part for my own benefit, because I don't tend to follow crime news as it unfolds. I find it too heartbreaking and often really confusing, because when a case is fresh, the details that police release and journalists report are often half-baked, and I frankly hate that. I like to have some distance between the crimes I cover so I can see as much of the whole picture as possible. I assume other people operate the same way, so these episodes are a way to bring people up to speed on cases that they maybe have heard about in the news lately, but don't fully grasp. For this case, I'm relying largely on what the public record tells us. This case has been covered closely by journalists in North Carolina for more than a decade, and I've gone through the contemporaneous reporting, the court filings, the search warrants, and the pretrial proceedings to give you as clear a picture as I can of where things stand and what questions I'll be watching for when this case finally gets to a jury. Now, let's start at the beginning. Faith was born September 26, 1992, in Warren County, North Carolina. She grew up in Hollister, a small town on the Warren-Halifax County border, with her mother Connie and her older sister Rolanda, who was 18 when Faith was born and was, by all accounts, something like a second mother to her. She was also raised within the broader community of the Halawa Saponi tribe, of which Faith was a proud member. Now, the Halawa Saponi are the third largest Native American tribe in North Carolina after the Cherokee and the Lumbee. The name itself is a combination of Halifax and Warren, the two counties that form the tribe's ancestral territory. They received state recognition in 1965 and, as of Faith's death, were still seeking full federal recognition. The tribe is about 4,000 members strong, with more than 3,000 living within a roughly 10-mile radius along the Halifax-Warren County line. It's a tight-knit rural community. No grocery store near the tribal government, no commerce to speak of, just a Dollar General and a lot of churches. Life revolves around those churches and the tribal government, and faith was woven into both. This is Dr. Marty Richardson, the tribe's vice chief, in a talk about the Halawa Saponi people.
We are very adaptive people. We are very resilient. We've had to change over time, but we've had common strategies to maintain our community and identity. Over time, during the Jim Crow era, we were susceptible to many of the Jim Crow laws of segregation, of not being able to use certain bathrooms or just not being able to go certain places or do certain things. The Native people of North Carolina endured that for a long time, but we survived by largely favoring our relationships within the Native community to keep our people strong, to keep us together, and to keep us safe, to be quite honest with you.
In short, this isn't just a group, it's an identity. Faith was an active member of the Carolina Indian Circle and a volunteer at the American Indian Center, too. She had been one of the first people baptized at the Mount Bethel Baptist Church after it was rebuilt in 2000 following a fire. Her Sunday school teachers remembered her infectious smile. A deacon recalled that children always just gravitated toward her. The kids, he said, stuck right to her. She was also, by any measure, exceptional academically. In high school, she was an honor student, a cheerleader, involved in practically every extracurricular available to her. She earned a Gates Millennium Scholarship to attend UNC Chapel Hill. That's a program that awards roughly 1,000 full scholarships a year to minority students with high academic promise and financial need. When the award letters arrived on a Saturday, tribal leaders announced it the very next day at the annual powwow. It was, as people remembered later, a moment of tremendous pride, not just for Faith's family, but for the whole community. Now, her father, Roland, had also attended UNC Chapel Hill, but he hadn't finished. Faith was determined to be the first in her family to graduate. She was a biology major, working toward medical school, with a dream of becoming a doctor, a pediatrician specifically. The plan was that she would come home to practice medicine in the community that raised her. Her cousin, Gabrielle Evans, had the same plan. They were going to do it together. To get there, Faith was doing what a lot of scholarship students do. She hustled hard and stretched her money as far as it would go. She worked part-time at a Red Robin restaurant near the Durham border for grocery and gas money. She'd taken a hiatus during the spring 2012 semester to get her financial aid sorted and then returned for her third year at UNC. She was staying with her friend and fellow student Karina Rosaria in Rosario's one-bedroom apartment at the Hawthorne at the View complex. The plan was they would room together until Faith's own place opened up later that month. Faith was also, that fall, pledging Alpha Pi Omega, a historically Native American sorority, and she was working on a video project for an anthropology class studying the process tribes go through to receive state or federal recognition. I mean, in other words, she was super engaged with her heritage as she built her future. Marcus Collins, who was both Faith's academic advisor and an advisor to UNC's Carolina Indian Circle, saw her during the week she was killed. His description of her, given at a memorial event months later, was simple. She was, quote, full of life as ever. She was one of those people that really saw the good in people. While she was here, and even going forward, she challenged us that way, end quote. Which made the way she died all the more gut-wrenching, from Crime Watch Daily.
She was beaten. She was bludgeoned to death. A lot of people don't understand what that means, but it was really bad.
Her father, Roland, said,
I don't know how I even functioned after I heard, after I got the news. All I remember was crying uncontrollably for a long time.
He kept listening and re-listening to the last voicemail Faith ever left him.
Hey, Daddy. I love you a lot, and it's time to call. And I love you a lot. And I guess I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Faith, of course, had no idea it'd be the last thing she would say to her father. The first time he heard it, he didn't know either. But now that she was gone, he treasured it. In its 21 short seconds, Faith had told him she loved him twice. That's the kind of daughter she was. It made no sense she had been taken away, especially in such a brutal fashion. After the break, we'll go over what exactly happened that night. The evening of Thursday, September 6, 2012, began normally enough for Faith Hedgepeth. Around 6 p.m., she attended a recruitment event for Alpha Pi Omega, the sorority she was hoping to join. She left around 7:15, telling people she had a paper to work on about the history of her tribe. She and Karina Rosario headed to Davis Library on the UNC campus to study, arriving about 8 p.m. Between 8:30 and 9, Faith exchanged texts with her dad about the sorority. At some point, she stepped away briefly from the library to see a friend, but she came back, and then, around 11:30, she and Rosario wrapped up their studying. They returned to the apartment together, arriving right around midnight. Now, my college days are long behind me, so I would have been wiped at this point, but Faith wasn't even quite 20, so her night wasn't over. She and Rosario stayed at the apartment less than 30 minutes before heading out around 12:30 a.m. for a nightclub called The Thrill on Rosemary Street in downtown Chapel Hill. It served drinks, but also catered to the under-21 crowd for dancing. Surveillance footage shows Faith and Rosario arriving at 12:40 a.m. They were there for about an hour and a half. Rosario told police they left because she wasn't feeling well. Surveillance footage confirms they left together at 2:06 a.m. They returned to the apartment. And then the accounts get harder to pin down. Rosario told police that she started texting and calling people from the bathroom, which isn't something I would do if I weren't feeling well past 2 in the morning, but again, I'm not a college kid anymore. I do remember doing some things that would seem pretty stupid if my movements on any given night were scrutinized afterward, but I was lucky enough to never have anything this awful happen to me. Anyway, Rosario still wasn't done for the night. She left the apartment about 4:25 a.m., getting a ride from a UNC student named Jordan McCrary, whom she'd seen at the club earlier in the night/morning. She said she left the door unlocked when she left. From court documents, we can get a little more specific about that window of time. At 3:05 a.m., Rosario texted McCrary saying she had been hit for, quote, no reason. There was nothing elaborating on that. She didn't say who hit her or where it happened. At 3:41 a.m., a text was sent from Faith's phone to a guy Rosario had dated. The recipient later told investigators the message was out of the ordinary. Neither the timing nor the content made sense to him. It basically told him he should check on Rosario, who needed him. Investigators said the writing style matched more closely to Rosario than to Faith, though. Meanwhile, Rosario texted McCrary a couple more times, and he came by the apartment to get her. When McCrary arrived, he noticed a small amount of blood on her finger when Rosario got in the car. She said she didn't know where it came from. She had no cuts on her finger and wasn't bleeding otherwise, according to the court documents. A smudge of blood was also found in the bathroom on the door frame where Rosario said she'd been sitting before she left. And the shirt Rosario had worn to The Thrill that night, which she told police she had left at McCrary's house, was later found near Faith's body. Rosario returned to the apartment with a friend named Marisol Rangel at around 11 a.m. She called 911 at 11:01, telling the dispatcher that her roommate was unconscious and there was blood everywhere. I'm only going to play a snippet of this. 911 calls are the worst moments imaginable in people's lives, and I don't want to be any more exploitative about this than a true crime podcast inherently is.
Okay, you say your friend is unconscious?
He's unconscious. I just walked in the apartment and there looks like there's blood everywhere.
Okay, listen to me. Listen to me. Somebody's already sending me ambulance. Okay, I need to get some information from you, and I'm gonna tell you how to help her, okay?
Okay.
Rosario didn't want to touch her friend, but the dispatcher insisted.
Ma'am, we need to find out if we can help her or not. You've got to, do as I'm asking so we can help her. All right?
Okay.
Rosario was instructed to look in face mouth for food or vomit, but Rosario said there was too much blood to see. The dispatcher asked her to touch her to find out if she was warm or cold. Rosario said she was cold. After that, the dispatcher said, "Don't touch anything else. Step out of the room. Wait for the paramedics." Now, I share this because it's been scrutinized like crazy in online circles. Some people say Rosario's behavior and her reluctance to help is suspicious. She must be hiding something. Maybe she's even the killer, they say. But to be clear, Rosario's never been charged. Police have said they don't believe she's connected. And I admit I find it kind of gross when people decide how someone's supposed to react to finding their friend dead. I mean, is it how I would have handled it? I can't know for sure, but I'm pretty certain it's not, because when I'm faced with something awful, my emotional brain does tend to shut off and I go into problem-solving mode. It's actually a little unsettling. I've also been reading autopsies and crime reports for decades, so while I would turn into a basket case after the crisis, I feel pretty sure that during it, I'd be getting my DNA all over trying to save a life. But everyone handles stress and trauma and even blood differently, and how I handle something isn't how my friends would handle it, and neither of us would be doing it wrong necessarily, we'd just be doing it differently. Also, it's worth noting that outside of the 911 call, some of the details about Rosario's comings and goings the night of the murder come courtesy of defense filings in the case against the man who's now charged with the crime. And defense attorneys don't file stuff for fun. They're likely laying groundwork for a someone else did it defense and or highlighting holes in the prosecution's case in hopes of a favorable plea deal. After all, there are definitely some problems with the case, but trying to pin the murder on Faith's roommate is going to prove tricky because the killer left behind DNA. We'll talk about that when we get back.
On Crimes of the Centuries, you hear about cases that leave a mark on history. Sometimes the things that keep you up at night or make you feel foggy aren't about willpower. They're about what your body needs. Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers brings together seven forms of magnesium to support sleep, stress response, and recovery. It's PhD formulated and backed by over 20 years of research and more than 15,000 lab tests. If you're ready to feel more rested, calm, and clear, head to bioptimizers.com and use the exclusive code RON to get 15% off any order. Again, that's 15% off at bioptimizers.com with code RON.
While investigators started their work, the Halawa-Saponi community did what tight-knit communities do. They gathered. The Sunday after Faith Hedgepeth's body was found, more than 1,000 people showed up on the sacred grounds of the tribe, filling the bleachers normally reserved for the annual powwow for an observance at dusk. Drummers played, dancers joined in an intertribal dance while Faith's family looked on. People danced in a circle around burning incense. Later, there was an honor song. Melissa Richardson, the tribal council chairwoman, said the community was reeling. They couldn't make sense of how anyone could do this to Faith, of all people. The tribe's chief, Ronald Richardson, called Faith, quote, "the epitome, the personification of love, laughter, joy," end quote. Meanwhile, Chapel Hill police were confident from early on that they had what they needed to solve this case. In January 2013, 4 months after Faith's body was found, they made their first significant public statement about the evidence. They had DNA from a man confirmed by the South Carolina State Crime Lab. It was in the rape kit, it was on the liquor bottle, and it was on a note left near Faith's body. The note was a sloppily written 5-word missive scrawled on the bottom of a white paper bag, as in the kind often used for carryout food. Written in all caps with a ballpoint pen, it read, "I'm not stupid, bitch, jealous." It's a bit cryptic, made even more so by the lack of punctuation. Tom Gasparoli, a News and Observer columnist who wrote about the case, said maybe the message was written sort of out of order. Maybe it was meant to read, "I'm not jealous, stupid bitch." If you look it up online, it's honestly hard to decipher. "I'm not" and "bitch" and "jealous" are arranged more or less on top of each other, and then "stupid" is off to the right, but still basically on the same line with "I'm not." I don't see "I'm not jealous, stupid bitch" for what it's worth. What I do see is an odd piece of evidence. The note was free of blood, which is weird because the scene was so bloody, and the note was found near Faith's body. It suggests that the note wasn't written in the same room Faith was killed. Who kills in what appears to be a fit of rage, then writes a note to the victim to leave behind? Unless the killer wrote the note first and then killed her, but he'd still have to place the note near her body. I mean, it's weird, right? Anyway, for Faith's family, this clue, and more so the discovery of DNA, had to have been somewhat promising, as much as anything could be in such a terrible situation. DNA evidence has a kind of CSI-era magic attached to it. I mean, you hear DNA from the scene and you think, great, they know who did this, an arrest is coming. But of course, DNA is only as useful as the database you're comparing it to. If the person whose DNA is at your crime scene has never been arrested or been in the military or voluntarily submitted a sample, their profile doesn't exist in any law enforcement database. You can't search a DNA profile the way you can search a face in the crowd. You need a name to test, or a hit from a database, or, as investigators would eventually discover, a very long, painstaking detour through someone's family tree. Until then, you have a perfect biological fingerprint of your killer, and absolutely no one to match it to. 6 months after Faith's murder, police had no idea who the killer was, and Faith's family worried that people would forget about the case. They reached out to a Native American band called Dark Water Rising, who wrote a song and filmed a video dedicated to Faith in hopes of keeping her name in the news and on people's minds.
Hometown hero, lost a life.
Faith wasn't forgotten, but her case went cold. Months turned into years. Her family and the Halawa Saponi community were trapped in a hellish purgatory that was as unfair as it was frustrating. They knew the evidence existed to convict whoever did this awful thing, but they couldn't magically conjure a suspect to solve the case. They grew impatient with police. Faith's brother told WRAL-TV,
"They tell me the same thing pretty much every time I talk to them, but I still make it a point to reach out to them because I don't want them to think that, you know, that we're forgetting."
In fairness, Chapel Hill police conducted thousands of interviews. They tested hundreds of DNA samples, too, some 229 in total, according to Attorney General Josh Stein speaking in 2021. They ruled out men who had been at the Thrill that night, former boyfriends, persons of interest flagged by tipsters. One early suspect, a former boyfriend, was tested and excluded. The FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit developed a profile. The killer was likely familiar with Faith, may have lived near her, was likely unaccounted for during the early morning hours of September 7th, and may have shown an unusual interest in the case afterward, or a sudden change in behavior at work or school. Seems pretty vague to me, but okay. Now, the records in the case were being kept from the public. A judge sealed the search warrants initially, then resealed them in March 2013 for another 60 days, and again after that. The justification each time being that releasing the information could undermine the investigation. And that's a legitimate concern in an active case. But it's also a justification that's very hard to challenge from the outside, and one that effectively kept journalists and the public from scrutinizing what investigators were actually doing. And then as the years passed, it risked keeping people from knowing what exactly police were doing to keep the case active. And that's also a valid concern. And in my other life, reporting on potential wrongful convictions for what if they're wrong, I know from experience that police can sometimes shelve the case they're no longer actually working and stall journalists whose fresh eyes might legitimately help solve the thing by saying, nope, you can't see the records because it's an ongoing investigation. Except, you know, there's nothing actually ongoing about it. And because this case involved a non-white woman who belonged to a tribe, crimes against whom are notoriously underreported and underinvestigated, people were even more concerned that the case wasn't being given the attention it deserved. To that end, the Daily Tar Heel, UNC's student newspaper, fought to unseal records as early as November 2012. Media organizations continued pushing. It took until 2014 for search warrants to be released, and those didn't reveal much. In 2016, police released a computer-generated composite image of a possible suspect created by Parabon Nanolabs using DNA phenotyping, a technology that predicts physical appearance from genetic material. The composite suggested a man who was likely Latino, with dark to light olive skin, brown or hazel eyes, and black hair. Police were careful to note the composite did not rule out that others may have been involved. It generated attention. It did not generate an arrest. As the years crawled by, online sleuths had plenty of time to come up with their own theories. Some of them centered around an admittedly strange voicemail. Now, I mentioned already, I am not a fan of red herrings, so let's be clear here. As far as we know right now, this is just that. But I can't leave it out of the story because it's important to hear. How this was handled is basically why I don't like following crime cases as they're unfolding. Okay, so it goes like this. After Faith's death, a friend of hers turned over a recording of a voicemail to investigators. The night Faith died, Faith had called this friend's phone. The friend didn't answer, and a bit of a garbled recording was captured. ABC News made a lot out of this recording. Bear with me, because this is a longer excerpt than I usually use, but there's a reason for it.
You're listening to a voicemail that came from Faith's phone on the night of the murder to her friend, Una Chavis. It was probably unintentional, the result of an accident we've all made.
She's notorious for doing a butt dial phone call where she accidentally calls somebody with the phone in her pocket, so I just assumed that was what it was.
If it sounds undecipherable to you, you're not alone. But when we brought Roland into WTVD to tell us what he hears, he was unequivocal.
I hear screaming in the background, and his face, voice. We're screaming. Please. Get off me.
Roland's assessment is simple. His daughter is in grave danger.
It's just my baby girl's voice, and I know her voice.
The distraught dad searching for closure? Maybe. But friends hear Faith, too.
I do hear her voice, and it does sound like she's yelling, maybe upset, maybe trying to get somebody's attention, but she does make some type of noise. And she's my friend. I knew her for 2 years. I talked to her every single day, so I'm sure that it was her voice at that point.
We brought others into the studio for a listen as well. Gasparoli says what he hears sounds like an argument.
Well, right there.
Possibly the two roommates fighting. And possibly a prelude to murder.
It sounds like there's a female who's very angry, very intense, speaking in staccato.
Gasparoli, you'll remember, is the columnist who had written about the case. He's not an audio expert. And I don't consider myself one either, but I do work in audio for a living, and I feel confident saying this much. There's no way you can make much out of that recording. I mean, I believe the father and the friends who say they recognize Faith's voice exists on the tape, but you can't make out a word of it. Recordings like this are like overexposed photographs. You can't bring the detail back in, so you're left with a hot mess that's really in the ear of the beholder. And forget Yanny Laurel. The auditory illusion potential is off the damn charts. But more than that, and this is super important, police say that this voicemail was not left at the time Faith was killed. It was left while she was at the club, and we know she left the club just fine because there's video footage of her leaving. So yeah, red herring. And yet, this recording took on a life of its own anyway. Names got attached to muffled syllables. Gasparoli used it to suggest Rosario was the killer. I mean, what the what, people? Strangers became convinced they had cracked the case from their living rooms based on a recording they'd never actually heard, only a TV show's presentation of it, alongside a stranger's interpretation of it, repeated and amplified across forums and comment sections until it calcified into something that felt like fact. I'm not lecturing, though. Our human brains don't like unsolved cases. We desperately want stories to make sense, and so we'll take kernels of clues released in media reports and devise our own theories. It makes us feel safer. I get it. But man, I'd love it if the people listening to this show could be among those who say, nope, I'm not going to blame some 20-something roommate I've never met for a horrific murder when there's no real evidence to back it up because I can't possibly know what happened at that crime scene. Whew. By 2019, so 7 years in, investigators turned to a newer tool, forensic genealogy, the same technology that had helped crack the Golden State Killer case the year before. Using the DNA collected from Faith's apartment, analysts search genealogical databases to identify people who shared genetic material with the unknown suspect. That led them to distant relatives. Those relatives were interviewed, their DNA was collected, and using that information, along with other records, investigators eventually identified a promising suspect. His name was Miguel Enrique Salguero Olivares, and he was a Durham man who had never been investigated at the time of the murder. Once investigators zeroed in on him, though, they found he had lived in an apartment complex on Ephesus Church Road in Chapel Hill before he moved to Durham. That's maybe a 10-minute drive from Faith and Rosario's apartment. Now, he seemed promising, but investigators needed a direct DNA sample from Salguero Olivares himself to confirm the match. On August 16, 2021, Raleigh police found Salguero Olivares asleep in his running vehicle, an open container of alcohol nearby. When he was awakened, his speech was slurred, so he was arrested for driving while impaired. North Carolina jails routinely collect DNA from people arrested and run those profiles against pending cases. His sample was collected September 14th. That sample went to the NC Crime Lab in Raleigh. Days later, North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein held a press conference.
Good afternoon. I'm North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein, and I want to start with a message to the family and friends of Faith Hedgepeth. I am so profoundly sorry for your loss. Faith was a bright, friendly, beautiful young woman whose life was full of promise and tragically and brutally cut short. While we understand that nothing can fill the holes in your hearts, we hope that knowing that a suspect has been arrested and is off the street reassures you that we are one step closer to justice for Faith.
Not only did the DNA match, but the News and Observer reported that search warrants indicate a palm print left on the liquor bottle at the crime scene, a bottle thought to be the murder weapon, also matched Salguero Olivares. He was arrested September 16th on a first-degree murder charge. It came 9 years and 9 days after Faith Hedgepeth was found dead in her apartment. We'll talk about what comes next when we come back.
On Crimes of the Centuries, you hear about cases that leave a mark on history. Sometimes the things that keep you up at night or make you feel foggy aren't about willpower. They're about what your body needs. Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers brings together 7 forms of magnesium to support sleep, stress response, and recovery. It's PhD formulated and backed by over 20 years of research and more than 15,000 lab tests. If you're ready to feel more rested, calm, and clear, head to bioptimizers.com and use the exclusive code RON to get 15% off any order. Again, that's 15% off at bioptimizers.com with code RON.
Miguel Enrique Salguero Olivares was 19 years old at the time of Faith Hedgepeth's murder. He had recently immigrated from Guatemala and spoke little English, according to a friend of his mother's, who spoke to the Durham Herald Sun. Since his arrest in September 2021, he's been in the Durham County Jail, held without bond. He's now 33 years old, and he faces even more charges than he did initially. In November 2024, prosecutors added burglary, rape, and sexual assault to the original first-degree murder. They believe Salguero Olivares broke into Faith's apartment and raped her before bludgeoning her to death. Durham County's DA is not seeking the death penalty. Trial is set for September 28, 2026. And getting to that date has not been easy. By the State Crime Lab's account, the case has generated more reports and analysis than any other case it's worked. The sheer volume of evidence, obtained and generated by multiple agencies investigating on and off since 2012, has created a discovery process that keeps hitting snags. Then Salguero Olivares hired a new defense team at the end of 2024, and prosecutors had to start the discovery sharing process all over again. At a November 2025 hearing, Durham Assistant District Attorney Angela Garcia Lamarca told the court that getting all the discovery together, confirming it was complete, and turning it over to the defense had been, in her words, our number one challenge. Superior Court Judge Keith O. Gregory, a Wake County judge appointed to preside over the case, was not keen to okay more delays. He basically said, "Yeah, we want a fair trial and the new lawyers need to be brought up to speed, but Faith's family has been waiting long enough. It's time to get moving." He's not wrong. That poor family. Now, as the trial approaches, there are questions sitting inside this case that go beyond the question of whether Salguero Olivares is guilty. Questions about how this investigation was conducted, what was preserved and what wasn't, and whether the systems around Faith Hedgepeth served her the way they should have. And these are all questions I'll be watching when this case finally gets to a jury, and the questions that may eventually bring it back to this feed as a traditional Crimes of the Centuries episode somewhere down the line. Now here's what I'm watching. Karina Rosario is expected to be called to testify, potentially not just as a witness for the prosecution, but possibly by the defense, too. Over the summer of 2025, defense attorneys filed motions seeking independent testing of blood evidence from the apartment. That filing revealed that police collected a swab of blood from the bathroom doorframe, as in, near the spot where Rosario said she was sitting and texting her friends. But when the defense requested the sample for independent testing, the state said it didn't have it, which is weird. Did they lose the evidence? That's not unheard of in a case with this many samples and with this much of a time gap between the murder and the trial, but it's never okay. It opens the door for the defense to say the investigation was shoddy, which can jeopardize a conviction. It's also pretty clear from the defense filings that they're going to try and pin the murder on Rosario, and unfortunately, a lot of the media coverage in the 9-year stagnation period is going to help them make the argument. You not only have the online chatter, but here you've got Roland Hedgepeth saying,
"I think the Karina knows what happened to Faith."
You've got columnist Gasparoli telling ABC he thinks Rosario was involved because she didn't say Faith's name during the 911 call. She just kept referring to my friend. You've got a neighbor named Joy telling ABC she saw Rosario come downstairs to wait for police after calling 911, looking serene.
That's the striking thing. You would never have known that they had just come from discovering what turned out to be a horribly brutal murder scene.
I mean, maybe that's true, but someone, please find me a manual on exactly how people are supposed to react to every gut punch situation we humans might someday face. I don't want to get it wrong. That said, I'll definitely be curious how Rosario handles court. Maybe it'll turn out she did see or know something. But I won't feel bad about giving her the benefit of the doubt right now, because that's how her system is supposed to work. I realize I might be a minority on this front. There are dozens of Karina Rosario did it posts online. I'll probably get a few emails from people making the case. Police haven't charged her with a thing, though, and I have no reason to think they would protect her. And while there's some elements of this that don't make sense to me, I'm pretty cautious about jumping to she's a murderer based on she did weird things. That's just me. Now, I am curious about a few other things, too. Police and prosecutors are, rightly, keeping some of their theories close to the chest. They haven't said if they think Miguel Salguero Olivares just happened to be at the apartment complex that night, or if they think he knew Faith Hedgepeth. If he didn't know her, to me, it actually makes the five-word note left by the killer make a bit more sense. I mean, those five words, I'm not stupid bitch jealous, could have been scrawled as a way to make police think she knew her killer, which is what they thought at first. It could have been Salguero Olivares actually inserting a red herring himself. It seems possible anyway. And I'm curious how the defense is going to try to spin Salguero Olivares' DNA being apparently all over the crime scene, including in the rape kit. I mean, are they going to claim he had had consensual sex with Faith and left her alive, and then evil roommate Rosario came in and killed her? And that'd be my guess. But then his DNA was on the bag with a weird note. So will they try to say Rosario was the killer and forced him to be part of it? That feels a stretch, but defense lawyers gotta defend. In short, a DNA match is pretty conclusive, but it's still not a conviction. This case has a long way to go yet. For Faith's family, I imagine the September trial can't come fast enough. To research this case, I read contemporaneous reporting from the News and Observer and the Durham Herald Sun, including coverage by reporters Jenna Smilek, apologies if I mispronounced your name, J. Andrew Curlis, Aaron Moody, Gloria Lloyd, and Virginia Bridges. I reviewed search warrants released in 2014, court filings and defense motions from 2025, and official statements from the Chapel Hill Police Department, the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, and the Office of Attorney General Josh Stein. This episode was suggested by listener Nahava Chavis. Thank you. Crimes of the Centuries is a production of Grab Bag Collab. To subscribe, go to grabbagcollab.com. This episode was engineered by me,